This tape is produced and distributed by the Christian Biblical Church of God, Post Office Box 1442, Hollister, California, 95024. This is Scripturalism versus Judaism number 11. I don't know how long the series will go. I'll try and intersperse it with some other things. This one will be just a little bit different from what we've covered before, because many of you at the feast received it. I don't know if I can include it in the mailing. I'll see how it goes. But if not, for those of us here, I want you to go ahead and pick up this one that has a picture of the temple. For those of you who have a Harmony of the Gospels, this is very similar to the one that I have depicted with artist rendition in the Harmony of the Gospels, because this is taken directly from the model that is the official model in Jerusalem. And the other one is a very unique picture. Now, I want you to look at it carefully. It shows a picture, an aerial picture of the Dome of the Rock. Now, I want you to look right close to it, because there is a depiction and outline of where they can put the temple of God, supposedly, right next to the Mosque of Omar, so they don't have to destroy it. And as I mentioned some time ago, you can be guaranteed that there would be absolutely no agreement between the Jews and the Arabs unless there was a consideration for them building the temple. I think we see it right there. Now, if you will look at the picture, the aerial view with the temple superimposed upon it, I was amazed when I saw that outline done this way, because someone's recently sent me from their archive something they've had for years and years, which was the original research that Leroy Neff of Worldwide Church of God did for his doctorate or his master's thesis way back in the 1950s. And it showed his conception of the temple as depicted by the information out of the Bible, and it looked just like this one here, which is right here, which is a little different than the one that you see, a little different than the one that you see. Oh, yeah, here it is right here. Well, no wonder I couldn't see it. I was looking at it upside down. How's that for, you know, be alert, Fred. Okay, no wonder. That's why it was hard to see. Anything upside down is hard to see. Okay, let's hope we get the Word of God right today. Don't read it upside down. But anyway, when we did some of the hymnals, we had one hymnal that we put in upside down and backwards. And so I caught myself doing it with one, but we had one that was already bound up, and Bob got it and said, "Look, we missed one." So it's going through there, and I turned it the other way to put it right side up, and it was just like a Hebrew book. You read it from, you start on the right-hand side in the back, and you go forward, okay, and all the numbers were on the inside. And so that's what I did with this. I turned it upside down. No wonder I couldn't see it. I looked at that, and I thought, man, that's not clear. How could the copy be that way? Okay, but there it is right there. Quite a picture of it. Now, and I appreciate everyone sending me different things, because this keeps me up on the events that are taking place, having different brethren out there being the eyes and ears for the news to listen and watch. Now, while we were at the Feast of Tabernacles, it came over CNN once. Now, I didn't hear it, but Marvin Wilson heard it, and he's checking on it because he knows the people at the Temple Institute in Jerusalem, okay? And the word came out that they were ready to start building the temple, and that part of the agreement that the Jews and the Arabs signed contained that agreement that they could build the temple. Okay? A week ago, King Hussein came out and said that his vision of Jerusalem was where all three of the world's great faiths, meaning Christianity, i.e. Catholicism and Greek Orthodox, Judaism, and Mohammedism or Islam could all worship in Jerusalem together in harmony. So, when I look at this outline of where they're going to build the temple, and remember what, 3 or 4 years ago, 5 years ago, I read to you an article from Biblical Archaeology where they discovered that really the Dome of the Rock did not sit on the exact location where the temple was, but was a little bit off, as most things that Arabs have generally are. Someone will decidedly get mad at me, but, you know, God is not going to let them have that particular section, because if it's in prophecy, there's going to be the temple built. Now, I want you to get your Bibles and turn to Revelation 11. And I want you to look at this diagram again, where the temple is proposed to be built in relationship to the Dome of the Rock. Revelation 11. And let's pick it up here in verse 1. And there was given to me a reed like unto a rod, that's a measuring rod or a measuring stick. And the angel stood, saying, rise and measure the temple of God and the altar and them that worship therein. But the court which is without the temple leave out and measure it not, for it is given unto the Gentiles. And they shall tread, the holy city underfoot for 42 months. Okay, now look at this diagram or the plot plan where they plan to put the temple. Notice that they are leaving off that area where the Dome of the Rock is. Now, part of the proposal is that they also extend the wall to the right. They extend it out a little bit further, considerably further, so that they will be able to have room to put the temple on it. So when Jesus gave the prophecy, let's go back to Matthew 24 now, okay? When Jesus gave the prophecy, no, let's go to Luke 20, and then we'll go into Luke 21. No, Luke 21, I beg your pardon. Luke 21 and verse 5. And as some spoke of the temple, how it was adorned with goodly stones and gifts, he said, as for these which you behold, the day shall come in which there shall not be left one stone upon another that shall not be thrown down. Now, when you look at what is there, there is what is called the Western Wailing Wall. That's where you can send your fax prayers, by the way. Remember that? You can have it squeezed in between the stones that are there. That is a stone upon a stone, isn't it? So this tells us that the prophecy has not been fulfilled where every stone is going to be taken down and scraped away. All right? Now let's go back to Matthew 24 and let's see something here showing that they are going to have animal sacrifices again. There will be a holy place again, and it's going to be then made desolate by the abomination of desolation. Now notice the time setting of this and how it fits in. Let's pick it up here in verse 12 and we'll come from there. Matthew 24 and verse 12. Because iniquity shall abound, the love of many shall grow cold. And boy, that is sure happening today. I mean, it is almost unreal, the things that are taking place and the cruelty that is happening to people. And it affects us, brethren, because we are not able to do the things the way that we would like to do, especially in relationship to other people that we don't know. Okay? Verse 14, and this gospel of the kingdom shall be preached in all the world for a witness unto all nations, and then shall the end come. And we haven't reached that point. We can ultimately say, yes, we know the two witnesses are going to preach the gospel. Yes, we understand that. They definitely are, and it's going to be powerful. But I don't think this has any relationship to that. I think that with all of the scattering of the churches and many hundreds and hundreds of churches, of God that there are. Now, we had quite a nice little presentation given to us by Alan Ruth, who gave a little history of some of the split-offs from WCG, and there are about 40 of them. Well, by the time you count all the churches of God everywhere in the world, I think we need to visualize this. God giving his Holy Spirit of conviction and testimony and evangelism, that wherever those churches are, there is going to be a tremendous witness of the kingdom of God given, and that's going to happen before the end comes. So what is said here is greater than what we've ever imagined, because we know with our former church experience, it wasn't complete, even though it was said that it was. Okay. Now, notice verse 15. When ye therefore shall see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet, stand in the holy place. There has got to be a holy place. And the holy place is in reference to the temple. Because you go back to verse 1, which ties in with what we read with Luke 21. Jesus went out and departed from the temple, and his disciples came to him and showed him the buildings of the temple. And Jesus said unto them, See you not these things? Verily I say to you, there shall not be left here one stone upon another that shall not be thrown down. So if there is a holy place, okay, there's got to be the temple rebuilt. Now here's this statement again. Notice verse 15. Look at that again, and this is one of these things inserted. And I love it in the New Testament. Every time you get to some place that's a little hard to take, or that's a little complicated, you have either he who has an ear, let him hear, or in this case, whoso reads, let him understand. Of course, Jesus didn't say these words. Matthew wrote it in there, okay? Now, how close are they to building the temple? What did the Jews themselves say? And I want you to understand something, that what we're going to do in this series of Judaism and Scripturalism, we are not going to go to any of the enemies of the Jews to find out what they say about the Jews. Okay? We're going to go to what the Jews say themselves about themselves. Now, here's a very interesting interview, and this was sent to me by Georgia Dujic, my Nose for News sister back in Ohio. And this is taken out of a magazine called End Time. The name of the article is Exclusive Interview, Rabbi Chaim Richman of the Temple Institute. You want to know who's going to build the temple? When they're going to build it? Ask them at the Temple Institute. Don't you think those would be the ones to ask? Yes, indeed. And Marv Wilson is in contact with them, so he's going to try and confirm this. He's, in fact, trying to do this right now. He's trying to get something back from Jerusalem from the people he knows there. Okay? So let me read some of the things. Let me read some of the things here concerning what they say concerning the temple. And you are going to be amazed. Okay? Talks about who founded the temple and so forth. Okay. How long has the Institute been in existence? 5 years now. What is the main purpose of why all of this was conceived? Rabbi Richman. The main purpose of the Institute is to educate the general public as much as possible to the importance and the central role that the Holy Temple occupies in both in life, both in the Jewish people and of all mankind. Now, I want you to pay particular attention to their evangelistic efforts, okay? All mankind. I want you, if you can remember what I brought out several years ago about the Noahide laws and about the Jewish Messiah, okay? Keep that in some of those things in mind if you can remember some of it, okay? So, the question is asked, so in other words, you have a goal of building the temple, okay? And he said, yes, we want to be occupied with the commitment of building the temple as much as possible in our time. The goal of building the temple is not our goal, it is the goal of the Jewish people. It is one of the central themes of the Jewish religion, which God commanded the Jewish people. Now, I want you to understand, when they say Jewish, they take to themselves everything concerning Israel and Jacob. Okay? The goal of the Institute is to try and be as serious about that as possible and to do as much about it as possible. Maybe we could hasten the time by raising the awareness and consciousness of people as to its importance. Then the question is asked, what are you specifically doing to do that now? The major focal point of the work of the Institute is a permanent exhibition where we are creating vessels which are legal for use in the temple according to the complex requirements of Jewish law. There are approximately 93 vessels that are described in the sources in Judaism, in the Talmud, and in oral tradition which were used in the temple. We are now reconstructing these vessels in an exact fashion so they can actually be used immediately in the temple. These are made according to all of the requirements, including the sources of material. If it's gold, it's gold. If it's copper, it's copper. If it's silver, etc. So it's really the first time that any of these things can be seen since the destruction of the second temple almost 2,000 years ago. And you can go into the Temple Institute over there in Jerusalem and they will show you these things. And Marv Wilson took some pictures of it. And when they discovered he was taking it on the video, they told him to turn off his camera. So anyway, he did. But they were able to see some of the things. This is considered in Jewish law to be the first stage of building the temple itself. That is one area of endeavor. So they, in their own mind, are already building the temple because they are making these things. Okay. In addition to the restoration of the vessels, we have an ongoing scientific and research-related projects geared toward the awareness of the temple. And I'll guarantee you that's for soliciting money, as well as religious things. We're also training young men for service in the temple, and we are involved in various educational projects, which include the production of books, films, and other audiovisual material. In general, we conduct a campaign to do as much as possible in every area to bring forward the time when the circumstances will present themselves wherein the temple will be able to be built. It is no accident that all of these things, the peace agreement, the things that are taking place in Egypt and the projects that they are doing. I've got here a news clipping sent to me of the combined Jewish and Arab projects that they are going to have, that they're going to do in the way of banking and making money. And it is going to be fantastic. So I don't think we have fully understood what it means when they say peace and prosperity, because I don't think we understand how far God is going to let this go or how great it may become. Then he makes a comment that we are seeing all these things in this time that are unfolding before our very eyes. The question is this. It's interesting that for the first time in 3,000 years, Arabs and Israelis are talking, wrestling with the problem of the final status of Israel. Of course, what the outcome of these talks will be, we don't know at this point. What is the feeling of you who work at the Temple Institute as to where the temple must be located? Now, here's his answer. We saw one conception of it, but here's his answer. Rabbi Richman, the temple goes on the Temple Mount, as you are aware. The Temple Mount, as it stands today, is the largest man-made plateau in the world, the equivalent of about 24 standard football fields. The sanctified Temple Mount in Second Temple times was a much smaller area, about 500 cubits by 500 cubits, which is less than one-fifth of the present-day area. There are a number of opinions in Jewish laws and academic circles about establishing the exact spot of the temple. They're arguing more or less about the same 300 feet or so. Some say a little bit more north, some say a little bit more south. The major trend in rabbinical circles is to believe that the spot of the Holy of Holies is that which is presently covered by the Dome of the Rock. Now, that's what they would like to do. They would like to get rid of the Dome of the Rock, but I'll guarantee you they can't get rid of the Dome of the Rock to build their temple because the Arabs won't let them do it. But the Arabs will let them build their temple alongside of it. And that's what's going to happen to fulfill the prophecy. Look, here's the question. In that article, it said that they designed a temple which would be elevated over the Western Wall Plaza. That's the one that you looked at here. This would allow for leaving the Dome of the Rock in place. Have you heard anything like it? No, I haven't. It doesn't jibe with the sources of Judaism, said Richmond, because there is only one place in the world for the temple to be. That is extremely exacting to the inch, and nothing can change that. It is not subject to negotiation. You mentioned the peace process and the fact that the Arabs and the Jews are sitting together for the first time in 3,000 years. That doesn't excite me very much, accepting that I see in it the hand of God. It certainly has interesting ramifications, but as far as we are concerned, the status of Jerusalem is irrevocable and not up for negotiation, nor is the entire land of Israel. Either we believe God or we don't, and either we believe in the destiny of the Jewish people or we don't. Now listen to this next sentence. The Jewish people are responsible for bringing about the ultimate redemption of mankind. Let me read that statement again. The Jewish people, not Jesus Christ, are responsible for bringing about the ultimate redemption of mankind. Now you know why all these things that we have read about in the protocols, international Zionists, all the things in the world are taking place now because they are busy fulfilling their own prophecies. They are going to save the world. We need to understand that. The Jewish people feel that it is their destiny to save the world. And they feel that it is their destiny to bring their religion to the whole world. Then there's a question about the red heifer. We've heard different things concerning the red heifer, which then is to be burned holy for an offering to sanctify and to cleanness. There's been a lot of talk about the red heifer. Could you tell me why the red heifer is so important from the Jewish and biblical perspective? This touches upon one of the most complicated areas of Bible law. That is the area of ritual impurity. There are a variety of types of purity and impurity in the world today to which our humanity has been exposed. The best way I can describe the ritual impurity to you is to describe a spiritual imbalance. It's not a question of someone being dirty. It's a question of there being a lack of a spiritual level. There are various types of impurity in the world, and some of these are not as serious and can be circumvented in various ways, but the most severe type of ritual impurity is that which exists in the world today. There is only one cure for it. In other words, they're saying the cure for the sins of the world can only be done through the ashes of the red heifer. Okay? There is only one antidote, and that is the process of purification through the ashes of the red heifer. This is the greatest mystery in Judaism. The ashes of the red heifer is the only thing that can be used to purify those who have come in contact with death. The impurity, the spiritual imbalance caused by exposure to death is so serious that it prevents the building of the temple. It is only the impurity that can prevent temple service, and the only thing which is missing in our ability to use the vessels immediately in the temple. So therefore, the red heifer is the missing link in the entire process of the preparation of the temple. end time question. There's been a statement made that the ashes from the last red heifer that was offered must be have to be rediscovered. Is that true? Or could you start afresh and offer a red heifer now using those ashes for purification? Rabbi Richman. The second is correct. The first statement that you made is not correct. There are a lot of people who believe erroneously that it is necessary to obtain the original ashes of the red heifer in order to reinstitute the process of ritual purity. While it would be advantageous if we had those ashes, it is not a prerequisite in Jewish law at all. On the contrary, if we had red heifers which fit the requirements today, we would be able to begin the process all over again now. The last thing I'd like to talk to you about is the question to Rabbi Richman, is the Messiah? Okay? From your perspective, when Messiah comes, how will you know he is the Messiah? Richman, this is a very important question and one of the major differences between Judaism and Christian theology. Many people ask me why we rejected Jesus. That is a completely erroneous question. Now, please pay attention here, okay? In our minds, it's not an issue of rejecting him. To us, he didn't qualify because he didn't set up the kingdom, because it was alleged that he was born of fornication, because it was alleged that he was conceived in a menstrual period, and on and on and on. Okay. To us, he didn't qualify. In order to reject someone, they had to have been a possibility. He wasn't a possibility because, like everything else in the realm of Judaism, as I mentioned to you before, it's not a question of feeling, it's a question of law. The Messiah is a person who has a certain task to fulfill. Those tasks are clearly spelled out. The kingdom to be restored to Israel. You remember a scripture that the disciples said? Will you at this time restore the kingdom to Israel? The temple to be rebuilt, the ingathering of the exiles, the complete obliteration of evil from the world. I want you to think about the mark of the beast. And I want you to think about what is going on in Haiti today. How are they going to bring Haiti to its knees? Because they can't buy or sell, isn't that correct? An embargo. How do you think that they are going to enforce the obliteration of their concept of evil in the world? Mark of the beast. Question. What is the greatest evil in the mind of Judaism in the world? I'll ask that again. Question, what is the greatest evil in the mind of Judaism today which must be obliterated? Christianity. Remember those things we've read from the mouths of Jews in their own writings? Christianity is the most satanic and diabolical thing that has ever been foisted on the world, the greatest evil to have ever taken place. So when he says here, the complete obliteration of evil from the world, you know what they're talking about because you've read the rest of their writings. This man who wrote this does not understand what he's talking about. Okay? These are not things which Jesus did. So when a person comes who is, yes, a descendant of David, but also completely human, a regular human being who is the greatest political leader who ever lived, the greatest teacher who ever lived, who has the power single-handedly to turn humanity back to its original spiritual values, i.e. Judaism, and to reconnect every person to divine purpose, that person will be the Messiah. Interview from someone at the Temple Institute, brethren, I want you to know very clearly that the battle between Judaism and scripturalism has just begun. Okay? Now, let's get into the scriptures. Let's go to the book of Matthew. And one of the goals I have, brethren, that I want to do, I don't know how long it will take, and this is a project that is so long, I will have to say, I hope I do it in my lifetime, because I'm 59 now. I don't anticipate death real soon, but the project I have here is a long project, and that is for all the brethren who are in contact with me to have led them through the entire study of the whole New Testament. Now, we're making some progress. We covered all the book of John. Okay? We've covered all the book of Romans. We've covered half the book of 1 Corinthians. And I dare say, maybe that's one of those other series I need to do on the side to have it done, because that's what's happening in the church today. 2 Corinthians, we haven't done. Galatians, we've gone through the whole thing verse by verse on justification. Ephesians, the whole thing. Philippians, the whole thing. Colossians, we've done the first half of it at least a half a dozen times, plus what I've done on the Amplified Translation that I'm going to do now. Okay? We have done James. We have done 1 Peter. We plan on doing 2 Peter, 1st, 2nd, and 3rd John, and Jude. Yes, Martha told me we did up at the feast that was 1983. That's right. We did the book of 1 John. That's the first time I went through the book of 1 John. Yes, indeed. Okay? I did a series through Revelation, but I need to go back and redo that because there's so much more we need to understand. Now, one of the goals I've set for myself that I want to do, because I have to have a project to work on so I can keep at it, one of the things I want to do, which I said that I would like to do, is in my own personal study, I would like to start translating the book of Romans like I did James and 1st, 2nd Peter, 1st, 2nd, 3rd John, and Jude. So that is my goal. And I will have to say that when we finish this series on scripturalism versus Judaism, and we'll have surveyed almost all of the book of Matthew and many parts of the book of Acts, that we're a long way toward the goal of doing that. So you'll have to bear with me. So since I'm your minister, you're kind of stuck with me. So we'll see what we can do with it, okay? So we finished last time scripturalism versus Judaism number 10, and we finished up through chapter 12, and chapter 13 has all of the parables there, which we've covered it at one other time. So let's come to the very last part of chapter 13 and verse 53. And what I want you to do, as we are going through the confrontations between Jesus and the scribes and the Pharisees and the priests, I want you to see that the same attitude that I just read to you from Rabbi Richmond, okay, concerning the Messiah that they have today, was exactly the same attitude that they had toward Jesus at that time. Now, much more highly refined, because they've had 2,000 years to work on their explanation, see. But now, when you take the statement that it is the Jewish people's mission to bring redemption to the world, I mean, we're talking about some pretty heavy stuff. And if you think the international Zionist bankers have done a number on us, wait till they get done with that. Okay? Now, verse 53 of Matthew 13. Notice the attitude toward Jesus, even in the synagogue where he went every Sabbath, in which we pretty well determined, which was probably as much of a scriptural-centered synagogue as you could possibly have. Verse 53. And it came to pass when Jesus had finished the parables, he withdrew from there. And when he came into his own country, he taught in their synagogues, so that they were astonished and said, now where does this man get this wisdom and works of power? Is this not the carpenter's son? Is not his mother called Mary, and his brothers James and Joseph and Simon and Judas? And his sisters, are they not all with us as well? That does away with Jesus not having any brothers or sisters. That does away with the perpetual virginity of Mary, etc., etc. Right there. Just remember that ties in with the parallel account in the book of Mark. Okay. Where then does he get all of these things? And they were offended in him. Isn't that something? And it's true to this day that Christ the rock is a stumbling stone and a rock of offense unto this day. But Jesus said to them, a prophet is not without honor except in his own country and in his own house. And there he did not do many works of power or mighty works because of their unbelief. Really quite a statement, isn't it? When you stop and think, what would it take to prove to someone that Jesus was the Christ? You think of all the things that he did. To see it, you would think that seeing is believing, wouldn't you? But they didn't. Human nature and Satan is there to blind even the most obvious thing. That's why they're going to be in such rage when Christ comes back to this earth. And they see that sea of glass hanging right over Jerusalem, and all the battles have taken place, and then the three unclean spirits, like frogs, come out of the mouth of Satan, the false prophet, and the beast to go to gather all nations together to battle. They are going to be so blinded and so adamant, and you talk about signs that have taken place. You've gone through the seven seals. You've gone through the seven trumpet plagues. You have gone through six of the seven last plagues, and still are willing to fight. So some people won't be convinced of anything. So here it even affected Christ. Now think of that in relationship to our relationship with Christ. That's why Jesus said, if you pray and believe, all things are possible. So that's why in our prayers we must have belief. And when we don't have belief, we just have to say, God, I don't know. And I think that is my most frequent prayer now, brethren. I tell you, God, I don't know. Now let's see if we can pick up on some other things here now. Let's come in chapter 14 and let's pick it up here in verse 22, after he fed the 5,000, which was quite a miraculous thing. Boy, could you imagine what would happen if they had television crews out there? Could you imagine? But you could almost be guaranteed that there would be John Chancellor there giving his commentary. Well, we saw this, but we really don't know what kind of thing that this was. Okay, so then verse 22, and straightway or immediately Jesus constrained the disciples to get into the ship and said, you go on the other side before me and till he dismissed the people or the crowds. Having dismissed the crowds, he went up in a mountain apart to pray. And when evening was come, he was all alone there, but the ship, now in the midst of the sea, that is the Sea of Galilee, tossed by the waves, was contrary to the wind. Now here's Satan's good opportunity to go ahead and destroy all the disciples, right? Jesus is up on the mountain alone, so Satan comes down, who's the prince of the power of the air, stirs up a big storm, and here are all of the disciples out there rowing away, but they can't get anywhere, okay? And in the fourth watch of the night, which is basically from 3 o'clock in the morning to 6, Jesus went to them walking on the sea. And the disciples, seeing him walking on the sea or walking on the water, were troubled, saying, it's an apparition. That's what it means in the Greek. Okay? It says here, it's a spirit, but the Greek means apparition, and it is phantasma, from which we get the word fantastic and fantasia, you know, that it's an illusion, okay? And they cried through fear. But immediately Jesus spoke to them and saying, be of good courage, it is I. And the Greek there is ego e me, which is the double I am. Fear not. And answering him, Peter said, Lord, if it be you, bid me to come to you upon the water. And he said, come. And having descended from the ship, Peter walked upon the water to go to Jesus. Now, that took quite a bit of faith, took quite a bit of gumption, it took quite a bit of impetuosity and all of the good and the bad that Peter had. Okay. So there he is walking on the water and to go to Jesus. But seeing the strong wind, he was afraid, and he was beginning to sink, and he cried out, saying, Lord, save me. Now, there are many things you can get from this. If you don't keep your eyes on Christ, you're going to sink. You can go back to some of the Psalms which talk about my sins have come over me like the miry water, and I'm about ready to drown, and so forth. Many different things you can put with it. But the main key here is you must trust and you must believe. And immediately Jesus stretched out his hand and took a hold of him and said to him, O you of little faith, why did you doubt? Had good reason to doubt from a physical human point of view. First of all, it was his first experience of walking on water, right? Yes. Never done it before. Never seen anyone do it before. Okay, and it was in the middle of the storm. Now, you might have said, well, this is slick as can be if it were calm, because he could have gone right out to him. Okay, but here it is in the storm. But Jesus said, oh, you of little faith. And that means just a teeny little itty bitty micron of faith. You know what Jesus said concerning a grain of a mustard seed. Thanks to Judy. Thanks to Marilyn. I carry in my briefcase at all times a little packet of mustard seed. So I'm holding it now in my hands. And a packet of mustard seed is about the size of a wide ballpoint pen ball, which is just really small, okay? Now, Jesus said, if you have faith of a grain of mustard seed, you shall ask what you will, and it shall be done for you. Well, you talk about a lesson in faith. Well, we've got a lot to learn here as we're going along, right? Okay? But I thank you for this, Marilyn, and I'm always going to keep it in my briefcase, okay? There are two things I keep in my briefcase. One is this, and the other one is this blue ribbon. Because before I got this beat-up briefcase, which I have now, and I've been trying to find a replacement and can't find it because they're not wide enough, I had a little Samsonite briefcase, which was identical to Judy's. And we would always get them mixed up. So we got to the point of making sure that each of us had our own little briefcase. So Judy one day came in and she put a pink bow on hers and a blue bow on mine. And so I told her that I would always keep this in my briefcase. So I've got it. It goes back a little pocket right here. So I'm always carrying those two things in my briefcase. The bow to remind me of a sister and a friend who has been kind to me, and of another sister and friend who was kind enough to remind me of the smallness of the mustard seed. So if we have faith, apparently Peter didn't even have that here at this point. So that tells us then, brethren, how much we have to do to grow in grace and knowledge and faith and understanding. It's a whole lifetime project, you see? Now, I would have to say that this Rabbi Richmond has got a lot of faith in what he's going to do, right? Yes. Should we not have much more faith than that? Because ours is not an empty faith just based upon tradition. Ours is a living faith based on the Spirit of God. Okay, so when they entered into the ship then, the wind stopped. Just when they got on, when they came on board on a ship. Now just picture this, a huge, gigantic wind, just like it happened before, where Jesus commanded the wind and the water to stop, and it became like a sea of glass. So here Jesus and Peter get into the ship, and immediately the wind ceased. And those in the ship came and worshiped him, saying, "Truly,